Gaza. They want to enjoy it. And you hear videos of Israelis saying, yeah, we like to watch. We want to see. And people are saying, oh, the Israelis don't know. No, they know and they enjoy. There's a way that we're dehumanized. There's a way that they're also forcing us to fight with each other. The way that they're working on the deconstruction of the communities and having people moving back and forth, back and forth. This is all because Israel understood the importance of the tribe for the Palestinians. In 1948, the biggest mistake that was done that made us still resist until today is that our communities weren't dispersed. The refugees left to Lebanon, from Palestine to Lebanon. They stayed in the same streets, in the same neighborhoods, close to each other in the refugee camp. They called the street based on the name of the villages they were ethnically cleansed from. And they still marry until today from the same families. Gaza was a big example of that. It's a big refugee camp and people maintain the tribe. And the tribe is unbelievably important in times of war. And it's what creates the resilience. It's what creates the generational knowledge. It's what keeps us going strong. So they're fighting that so strongly now and dispersing some families in Egypt, dispersing some families in different places around the world. They're breaking the tribe to break our ability to come back and to resettle.
What about what some of the videos that we are also seeing of Israeli soldiers filming themselves sometimes torturing or tormenting Palestinians? And there's a video that was circulated recently of the soldiers tormenting this poor little boy who must be about, you know, between 9 and 11 years old, small boy. And he's crying and he's being, he's actually, you know, completely petrified in this video. And I was thinking to myself again, you know, we had Bassem Youssef on the show a few months ago, and he said, you know, nothing that they put out is, you know, accidental. Nothing that you see put out by IDF soldiers, whether that's them wearing underwear or then that's them looting, is coincidental. It is a part of a deliberate strategy. So how do you interpret these images that are coming out as part of the wider picture of psychological warfare happening?
They're trying to scare people. They're trying to scare people from moving, from acting, from talking in the West Bank and in all of Gaza. Also, the images with the lingerie for the Palestinian man, it's breaking our Palestinian men in knowing that their women, that if they're doing this to their clothes, what's going to happen to them if they capture the woman? This is pushing people to move and evacuate when they want them to evacuate, knowing there's a risk that your child will be taunted like that. Also, it means that in the West Bank, the parents will be trying to strangle their children from going out to protest and being in any way active, trying to shut down the televisions, not let them know what's happening in Gaza, and keeping people inside the homes so that nothing happens. The stories of rape didn't come out by accident. The sexual harassment of the Palestinian women prisoners did not come by accident. They're doing this specifically so people, they know our society, they study it, and we have, sadly, people amongst them who are from the society that support them. So they know how to break down the psyche of people.
There are also now, you know, by now, lots of well-documented examples of IDF soldiers, you know, urinating on people, forcing them to act like animals, people being attacked by dogs. You know, there are allegations that have been reported, even The Guardian, of the return of certain people with missing organs, desecration of graves. I mean, as a psychotherapist, looking at the level of depravity that is being exercised by Israeli society, and then, you know, recently we saw, you know, a video coming out from Tel Aviv where people are being asked, like, oh, how's things in Tel Aviv? And they're like, oh, it's so great here. Like, it's a vibe. Like, the food's awesome. How do you make sense of this as a psychotherapist, of this society who can, on one hand, be involved in literally torturing children, shooting them in the head, and come home and, like, party in a G-string and play beach volleyball? Like, how does this work?
This is part of the trauma that the Israelis endure. And the way that the Israeli society operates, they're put in states of fear, constant fear, since the Holocaust until today, especially in Israel. The Jews who are outside had a chance to at least do some healing. The ones who are in the state were given guns, told that this is the Nazis, go after them. and they remain on a state of fight flight since then. And they pass it to generations. They've dehumanized us to the point where they can't see us as humans. And the religion opens the way for that. They have verses that allow for us to be killed, raped, maimed, under the disguise of being strangers and going. The whole society is a sick society, in a sense. And they all need trauma therapy. When you talk about soldiers committing suicide, the violence, and internally, when you're taught as a child to discriminate against one person, you don't recognize that you discriminate only against one. You have the system operation, and the operation works on everybody. So you discriminate also against other people in your community. This is why there's so much racism within the Israeli society, in the different levels of the hierarchy of the Israeli society. They're taught, and this is why you see them when they're coming to suppress protesters now in Tel Aviv. There's severe violence because they can't distinguish. Those who are shooting in the West Bank come back and they're also very violent.
Given the long history of Israeli psyops, and for those who aren't familiar, I would advise you to take a little time out to research how Israel is a leader in psyops. What kind of psyops do you think or do you see already operating in the way that these platforms are curating information or getting us to think about the world? What is it, do you think, that people need to be attentive to from a psychological perspective, from a mental health perspective, about how, you know, very clearly now it's apparent that, you know, pro-Israel voices are working with these platforms where we think we are getting, you know, content directly from the source?
These tools, these platforms are there to share information, but they're not there to liberate us. It's very important for people to send letters to the MPs instead of scrolling. It's very important to be outside asking, and they replace our community. They replace our direct interaction with people. And when activists sit together in community in a meeting, that's when action happens. It's not virtual. We made the mistake in the Arab Revolution, thinking that these platforms will help us, will get to people. But eventually, on the ground, they destroyed us. And having all of our information put out for them to use, we know how they're using the information to target, kill people. For the Palestinians, it's important to get the message out. For those who are on the support, it's important to share their messages 1 hour a day, maximum. To allocate time for that, for digital activism. But it's not your life. Your activism needs to be on the ground. Your activism needs to be taking Israel into courts. Your activism needs to be directed towards ending the genocide physically. Information is out there about this genocide. It's been 2 years. How are you going to shift somebody's brain? They've seen the trucks of people being loaded out of Gaza. We've seen the flotilla. But we need people to be standing in front of the Israeli embassies to protect the flotilla instead of only sharing on social media. We need people on the ground. And we need to realize that the reason why they allow us to have this gateway is because of that. They want virtual protests, and they want the desensitization of people to images.
Palestine has been recognized by the British government, by the Belgians, by Australia and Canada. This is being heralded as a big moment in the Palestinian liberation struggle. But the genocide is ongoing. And I want to ask you about how you sustain hope and action and cultivate the necessary optimism at a time like this.
I have hope for my children. I have hope in the generation of kids there who, despite it all, still want to sing and dance and still want to make friends and still want to make art and still want to play.
Yeah.
They give me hope, and I have faith, an unwavering faith, yaqeen, in the liberation of Palestine, and it's closer now than we have ever been before. I have faith that we will see Palestine free, and this gives me the hope and the energy to keep going. Every time I try to feel breaking down and I get burned out, and I'm human, I get burned out. I re-engage with all the tools that I have so that I can pick myself up and keep going for the kids and for Palestine and for humanity. It's not only Palestine that we want to liberate. We want to liberate the world. If we liberate Palestine and the Amazon dies, we have a big problem. I want this world that I love to survive, and this gives us the hope. Keep the music alive, I would say to every activist. Keep the Dabke alive. Keep the joy and the love of what you want and what you dream of Palestine to be when we are liberating it. And keep envisioning Palestine as free. See it free, know that it's going to be free, and just have that. Have that in your heart, in every move that you take.
Ashida, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Spring of Truth will follow next. This program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. And we finish off this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
Hello and welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Ahmad Ghazmi, and I continue to be joined by independent British journalist, Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is a long-standing campaigner for Palestinian liberation. Sarah, in part one of the programme, we spoke about the repression that you faced from the British state for your journalism on Palestine, and we were talking about the way in which the police operate here in Britain. We know that they're an arm of the state, but they're supposed to be operationally independent. But it seems that now they're not even operationally independent, right? There's just this pipeline of demands coming from the regime in Tel Aviv to the British government and then passed on to the police. And then this goes to a question that seems to rile up a lot of people, but which I think is very important, which is, who exactly is driving this push to silence pro-Palestine voices in Britain? I have my own view on that. Some people say that it just comes directly and organically from the British state, which supports Israel because it's simply a Western colonial outpost. But I think that oversimplifies the question, because we saw, particularly under Jeremy Corbyn when he was leader of the Labour Party, how the Israel lobby in Britain intensified and battle-tested new censorship methods to go after pro-Palestine voices in Britain. And that came from the Zionist entity. It didn't come from Britain. We saw how the former Israel ambassador to Britain, Mark Regev, worked to push these strategies. That's when we had the widespread rollout of an official definition of anti-Semitism with the IHRA working definition. We had the revival of a group like the Jewish Labour Movement to help take down Jeremy Corbyn. We saw the case of Shai Massot, the Zionist spy, working to take down even a conservative minister, Sir Alan Duncan. And it seems to me that the British state has been, over the past decade especially, increasingly captured and radicalized by the Zionist regime. And would you agree with that assessment, which is basically that the scale of the push against pro-Palestine journalists, activists and protesters here in Britain is primarily being pushed by external forces? And what's your take on that?
I was waiting for you to say occupied. Are we occupied? And yes, we are. Everything's coming straight out of the Tel Aviv playbook. Even the questions in interrogations, they're no longer following British protocol. You know, some of my interrogation questions were just outright racist. I think one of them, you know, why do you think Palestinian people are better than white people? I mean, I just find that an astonishing question. And it's clearly not a British question. So are we occupied? Yes, indeed. I think that we are very much so. So although, yes, it seems to be coming from the British government, you know, it's not just that we're allies, because as I've said before, who would have an ally that murders and maims? Well, yeah, the numbers are 70,000, but you know, we know that even if you look at the Lancet, you know, they were guessing the figures were over 200,000 Palestinians killed. I know that there's 15 or 16,000 Palestinian children missing, so on top of nearly 30,000 killed, there's hundreds of thousands of adults and children missing. So who'd have an ally that is murdering at this extent? Who would actually brag about having the same values as an entity that is basically using mass murder to ethnically cleanse an entire population? Who'd do that? And I can't believe that the British public aren't more shocked when you hear Ursula von der Leyen and talking about, well, we have, you know, similar values. It's, well, no, we don't. I don't know anyone who has the same value as a regime that is prepared to annihilate an entire population. And that annihilation is still going on. Let's not forget this yellow line that they've created. Then now this morning they've announced that they're moving the yellow line outwards to take more of Gaza's territory. And that yellow line obviously has about another 250 metres in front of it, where suddenly these yellow blocks appear. And let's not forget, it isn't a spray-painted yellow line. It's an invisible yellow line, and it's an excuse to continue the genocide, to continue killing innocent Palestinians, young children playing football, just who accidentally cross over this invisible line. The genocide, the ceasefire, they're one and the same. The ceasefire is just, I think I've used this phrase before, but it's a rebranded version of genocide. And I've also used the phrase of, you know, this is a Rubik's cube of genocide. So we're not just talking about starvation and disease. We're not talking about, you know, destroying the hospitals and the infrastructure, the sewage, creating a situation where hepatitis becomes rife and then there are no medications, the polio virus, you know, the bad weather, the fact that the pipelines are all destroyed. If you look at everything that the Israelis have done and are doing, then it becomes this Rubik's cube of genocide. It may not look the same every day, but it will still be a combination. And so, you know, even with this, am I going to call it a peace plan? No, it's a genocide plan that has been manufactured by the Israelis and the Americans, which they've also called, was it a board of peace? Oh, they're all such lovely words, aren't they? And a stabilization force to enable them to continue the genocide, but using these very lovely words. And it means that they can make the public relax. Oh, how do you feel now the war is over? I can't tell you how many times that has been said to me. And I've had to say, it's not over. The genocide never finished. It's continuing. It's going on. But it's just got nicer words around it so people think that it's finished. Was it 29 people killed this morning? Dozens of children. And then 25 people killed yesterday. These are airstrikes. It's continuing to bomb Gaza. So I don't know where the ceasefire fits into that, because as far as I'm concerned, that isn't a ceasefire. They're not stopping anything. They're continuing with the ethnic cleansing by death, or even by trying to bus them out and then fly them into South Africa. I'm glad South Africa has now put a stop to it. May get some criticism for it, but the point is it didn't want to be a party to ethnic cleansing. And that's what we're all complicit with. If we don't speak out as journalists, if we don't speak out as reporters and activists, if we don't keep telling the world this, they actually do sit back as if they were just watching an episode of Coronation Street and think it's all over. And the thing is, it isn't. We're halfway through. The ethnic cleansing isn't complete, and they will continue until it is complete. I may have strayed off your question a little bit. It's because there's so much of it, and it's because I think the general public have been conned. They've been conned by words, and I'd like to think they're a little bit more intelligent than that. It's disappearing out of mainstream media, certainly, and people keep saying now the war is over all the time. And for a start off, it was never a war. It was a genocide. And now we have this Trump Netanyahu genocide plan, which is against the Geneva Conventions, which is against the Apartheid Conventions, it's against the Genocide Convention. And yeah, I kind of want people to wake up.
Well, let's turn now to those ongoing developments. So, of course, you're talking about the recent UN Security Council resolution, which is this Western imposed colonial trusteeship, or a mandate, if you will, that seeks to dissolve Palestinian governance in Gaza, hand temporary administration of the land, well, they say temporary, but I think they mean permanent administration of the land, the same powers that armed Israel's genocide, to disarm the occupied people, or attempt to disarm them. I don't think they'll be very successful in doing that, while also throwing Palestinian statehood to the wind. I mean, what's your reading beyond what you've just said on what that signals about the future?
I think, isn't that what they always wanted? This was always the plan, you know, to dissolve Palestinian statehood, to prevent the Palestinians' right of return, which is an inalienable right, by the way, to, you know, not to have to pay reparation costs, to create a situation where Gaza is uninhabitable, to then, say, use voluntary migration, which is enforced migration, to get them out there, to continue killing, to find a way to continue the genocide but under a different form. Isn't that what they were always doing? I can't actually see the difference. This is exactly the same, but it's got some very pretty words around it. And now somebody's gone and voted. And I think the United Nations Security Council, oh my God, how spineless do they have to be? I don't know whether I was the only one praying for Russia and China to veto it, but no, it was worse than that. They abstained, which is like, we might have vetoed it, but we decided that we'd do a trade and stay and just stay quiet. I mean, it's even worse. So, you know, you're waiting for somebody to stand up and say, this can't go on. This plan is just about legitimizing genocide. It's about taking away accountability, and it's about allowing the Israelis to take Gaza over. Well, isn't that what they were always trying to do? Isn't that what they were doing when they were bombing it? And they are still bombing it. But isn't that what they did when they originally invaded it? Isn't that what has been happening for 77 years? I can't see how this plan is different from the illegal occupation. And as you rightly said, you know, occupations are supposed to be temporary. Here we have a permanent one. We have dozens of violations of international law just inside this. Oh, I'm going to keep calling it a peace plan, and I really don't want to. Just inside this Trump-Netanyahu genocide plan are multiple violations of not just the Geneva Convention, but, you know, international law itself, multiple violations. It is disabling the Palestinians the right to self-governance. There's nothing in this plan which is aimed at giving the Palestinians what they've always wanted and always resisted for, which is self-determination, which is the chance to actually belong to their own land and own their own land and govern their own land in their own way. No matter who they vote for, you know, it's removing their ability to continue living there. Well, isn't that what they were doing in the first place? This is just a different side of the Rubik's Cube. And it's a clever one because, you know, there are people that think, oh, you know, Trump's a hero. You know, he's come along and he's going to make peace. He hasn't made peace. You know, if 29 Palestinian people are slaughtered in one morning and then the day before another 25 and 13 children the day before. I'm not quite sure where that is peace. I'm not quite sure if you want to call that an incremental genocide because the numbers are smaller. Well, you know, eventually you will carry on and you'll have an entire genocide. Nothing has changed. I was even thinking about the Colombian peace plan when I read it. You know, everything was good until they said, you know, but of course, you know, we would like the Israelis to continue being able to have Jerusalem as their capital. Okay, so previous to that, they had stated that they had to withdraw back to the 1948 lines and, you know, they had to pull out and then no more settlements. And then they say, oh, but you can still have Jerusalem as your capital. So how in God's name do you do that when you've got to ethnically cleanse Jerusalem of the Palestinians? So in some ways, it completely contradicted the beginning of what they were trying to say. Theirs was the best plan. But at the end of the day, it's still once again an excuse to continue ethnically cleansing Palestine, central Palestine, Jerusalem. And then, oh, but we'll give you Abu Dhabi, we'll give you East Jerusalem as your capital. Which is actually a rubbish dump. Now I don't mean to insult Abu Dhabi. There are people that live there, and it's their environment, and it's their home, but it's been turned into a rubbish dump. And so, that's what's going to become the Palestinian capital when Jerusalem is their capital. I can't see how anything's changed. It's just been relabeled. That's my point of view, anyway.
Well, I mean, people talk about the fact that the Nakba never ended, that it's an ongoing Nakba. And it seems to me, quite rightly, as you've pointed out, that it really nothing has changed. All that changes is the pace and also the framing around the genocide. But the genocide always continues. And, of course, that was always the Zionist plan. Even if you look at the so-called Labour Zionists, who were the majority back then and sort of considered the more moderate wing of Zionism, not that there is any such thing, but David Ben-Gurion and the Labour Zionists, who of course were the people who created the Haganah, which then became the Israel Occupation Forces, and which carried out numerous massacres alongside Zionist terrorist organizations during the Nakba, they were very clear right at the beginning that they would only accept a partitioned state so that they could eventually take over the rest of Palestine. And of course that comes with, as I think Ben-Gurion said, brutal compulsion and also expulsion of the indigenous people, and not just their expulsion, but also their mass slaughter, of course, as we have seen. You made reference earlier to the Greater Israel Project, which is the Zionist expansionist plan to conquer all of historic Palestine, as well as to absorb parts of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and beyond. In the West, for many years, this has often been treated as some sort of conspiracy theory, but the Zionists talk openly about it, and they talk more openly about it now than they ever have before. And we even saw Netanyahu recently visit some of the newly annexed land, or the newly occupied land, I should say, in Syria. How serious is this Greater Israel plan, and what effects could that have for the region in the coming months and years?
I do hate making predictions because they often come true, but I there was a time when it wasn't okay to talk about the Greater Israel Project. People did think, you're right, that you were a conspiracy theorist, but it's absolutely true. And I think, I wonder whether some of our arrests and our trials and our court cases have been perfectly timed around 2027, 2028, and the end of 2026, when you will see a much bigger expansion going on. And that could very likely, when you know when they said they were going to bomb Gaza back to the Stone Ages, well, we're looking at Lebanon could very easily end up in this situation. We've only seen a small taste of it at the moment, and the southern Lebanon is being bombed and people are being killed, and now they're attacking a Palestinian refugee camp. But you know, a lot of Lebanese people, as we know, have been slaughtered, and the pager incident. And, you know, I think what we're going to see over the next coming year and towards the end of the year is a real push. The Greater Israel Project is going to actually start to become a reality. And by then it'll be too late. You know, the Israelis have played the better chess game, and we're sitting around just moving pawns around the chessboard. But it's going to happen. And I think Lebanon is a target. I actually think Jordan is a very big target, but I get into trouble for saying it. But I also think Syria, you know, and obviously there's parts of Saudi Arabia that are very much involved in losing their land to the Greater Israel Project, and North Sinai, I think the two places. And if you look at the Greater Israel Project, that takes the Suez Canal as well. So, I know that the Egyptian people are very supportive of Palestine, so this is not against the Egyptian people, but Sisi is being very careless about one of his main sources of income, and that's not just the tourist industry over the pyramids, but the Suez Canal. Now, if you look at the Greater Israel Project map, that includes the Suez Canal, that includes parts of Saudi Arabia, that includes pretty much most of Lebanon. I don't know what is going to be left of Lebanon. And I think if the countries don't start rising up, and rising up very quickly, you know, it's difficult when you've got America sort of pressing down on you, but, you know, if something isn't done very swiftly, I think that the same time that we are no longer able to post, we are no longer able to work as journalists and reporters. Don't forget, that's 250, Palestinian journalists have already been slaughtered. But we're also looking at the silencing of hundreds of very big people with very big platforms. That is when I think it will all happen. And this is a preparation. This taking us to court, accusing us of this, accusing us of that, trying to jail the people that have been on YouTube, like Richie Medhurst, you know, trying to jail Craig Murray, trying to jail myself, I suppose, trying to jail anybody who's been outspoken or anybody who's prepared to tell the truth tellers. Then it's all going to happen at that time when we become silent. And this is, you know, I've got a sort of, I suppose I'm not very positive about all of these court cases, because they do not want people exposing these plans. And how do we expose them? We expose them through social media. It's going to be difficult to stop people. There's a legal reason why they can't stop people using social media. The only way they can silence us is to jail us. And when we are all jailed, that is when you're going to see all of these things start happening, this mad push to start taking more and more territory in Syria, but Lebanon in particular, and Jordan. You know, I feel that Jordan is a holding platter. I mean, there's a lot of Palestinian refugees live there, but, you know, it is also a sovereign country whose king could be forced into exile. The Greater Israel Project is actually one of the most dangerous things that we have ahead of us. And I, in some ways, the British state is preparing a way, is preparing a pathway so that it can do that. It knows BBC isn't going to cover it. It knows that the mainstream news is not going to cover it. So it's got to silence all of the people that would cover it. And funnily enough, when you look at all of the names of the people who've been arrested, those are the ones who are most prolific on social media, on Twitter or other platforms, telling the world, wake up, this is happening. Now, they silence all of us. They're just going to quietly get along with it. And I think this is why the dates of the trials are done specifically, because these things are going to start happening by the end of 2026. I would be surprised if you don't see a lot more bombing in Palestine, maybe the destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which I think will make a lot of people gasp. But I do think the collapse of Al-Aqsa Mosque is imminent if they continue their excavations. Maybe all this will happen by the end of 2026 when we've all been silenced and we're unable to report about it. Hopefully somebody will fill in. But at the moment, people are terrified. People are terrified to take over, if you like, posting 30 to 50 tweets per day. It actually takes up your whole day. It's a full-time job. There isn't really anybody else doing it. So all of those investigative journalists, we're all being silenced. And I think we're being silenced for a reason. And the Greater Israel Project is the reason. And it has begun already. I think Francesca Albanese said it's already begun. And I think she's right. But it hasn't begun on a big enough scale that it's noticeable. And so they're getting away with it. And so, yeah, I do fear the amount of arrests that are being made, because they are prolific reporters and activists, and they're the ones that we need to pass on to the next generation, that something big is going down, something bad is happening, and your government is facilitating it. Do something about it. Get out on the streets. There is no ceasefire. This is all a ruse to make you relax. And so, yeah, it's another part of the Rubik's Cube.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to call our conversation to an end. I really appreciate the insights that you've been able to give, Sarah, and I want to express my support and solidarity with you. I want to wish you the very best of luck with your case. And I'd ask anyone who's listening to follow you and also your work if they aren't already doing so. Sarah, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
See you next time.
World, in short. چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on results and outcomes of the uprising of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him. The innocent, infallible Imams, peace be upon them all were killed, but their ideological school remained intact. The master of martyrs was killed, his ideology survived, rather revived. By his getting killed, his ideology remained safe. Similarly, divine authorities, most of them were defeated, but their ideology survived. The master of martyrs, together with his kin and disciples, were all massacred, but they advanced their ideology.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio about the subject of محرم عند عاشوراء Imam Khomeini رحمة الله عليه said lamentations for Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام keeping the movement alive and maintaining alive the fact that a small number of people successfully stood up against a great empire are orders of the day. Here, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi emphasizes the significance of standing against tyranny, even though the truth seekers be members of minority. When Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam started his revolution, he was aware of the consequences of his movements, you know. He was an infallible imam. Infallible imams' extensive knowledge and insights are beyond our heads. Imam Hussein alayhi salam revolted to set a role model and he refused to surrender. He asked people to help him, and when a group of people from Kufa expressed their willingness to accompany him on his path, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam accepted their offer and moved towards Kufa, and he did not give up in the middle of the way. Imam Hussein alayhi salam stood up against the deviated current of his time, which was extremely dangerous, and this became a lesson, and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam himself makes the same point. That is to say, he backed up his action with the order of Islam. He said that his duty was what he was doing. He said that he had to express his opposition no matter what the consequences were. He said, it is good if my destiny is a victory and if my destiny is martyrdom. So much the better. This was a perfect instance of self-sacrifice and safeguarding Islam. If Imam Hussein alayhi salam had not accepted this danger, if he had not made a move, if he had not taken action, if his blood had not been shed, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people in history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice, and we should really take lessons out of these. And this is what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh emphasized in this regard. Thank you very much for listening to us, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Our researchers whose work quietly shapes the future of how machines see and understand the world. They bridge the gap between abstract algorithms and real-world applications, pushing boundaries in fields like deep learning, computer vision, and intelligent document processing. My guest today is one such innovator, an academic and practitioner whose contributions span both cutting-edge research and impactful industry collaborations. With a passion for pattern recognition and a commitment to advancing AI education, he continues to inspire the next generation of scientists and engineers. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Ray.
Yusri Kesentini is an associate professor at the Digital Research Center of ESFAX in Tunisia, where he leads the Deep Vision research team. With a PhD in pattern recognition from the University of Rouen, France, and an engineering degree from the National Engineering School of ESFAX, his work centers on deep learning, computer vision, and document image processing. He has authored over 60 publications and actively collaborates with industry on technology transfer projects.
Dr. Yusri Kesantini, very good to have you on this program.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm honored to be with you today. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure, actually, to have you here in Iran as well. You're here for the sixth edition of the Mustafa Prize.
Yes, I'm invited for the ceremony, and it is the first time that I visit Iran, and I'm very happy to visit this nice country.
It is indeed pleasant for us as well, and I hope you enjoy your stay, the rest of it, as many days as you are going to be here, and I hope you come back so that you can travel also.
Sure.
Very good. Dr. Kesantini, what first sparked your interest in technology and artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I think it is my first experience in artificial intelligence. What it, was in the my end of study, engineering study, in this period I worked in the preservation of historical documents. I work in Flaubert draft. I don't know if you know Flaubert. Flaubert is a writer.
It's Gustave Flaubert.
Flaubert, yes.
I know,
yes,
of course.
Yes. It's Madame Bovary.
Yeah, very famous.
So I have worked in the preservation of the draft that write Flaubert for Madame Bovary.
The manuscripts.
Yes,
lovely.
The manuscripts. And I find this experience very, very interesting. So here we see how artificial intelligence can help historian to preserve these documents, to preserve our history, to get more accessible to our citizens, this kind of documents that are very, very in their paper version are very sensible.
How did you develop the project later on? Do you still work with the project or is it done?
After my PhD?
Yes.
No. Until now, in the Digital Resource Center, we continue to work on document images. This is a part of our works in my research team, in the division research team. And we work on other kind of document, like document enhancement, for example, using generative artificial intelligence. If the document is degraded, is the poor quality, if there is some noise, some watermark in the documents, how we can remove this noise before transcribing the document. Because if we work directly in the transcription of this kind of documents,
right,
of degraded documents, we don't get a good quality of OCR quality. So the idea is to propose some tools, some artificial intelligence tools, to improve the quality of documents, what we call document enhancement, and after that we can apply the transcription tools to get the text.
And how expandable this is to more languages? For example, if they want to apply the same thing to Farsi, or to some other language, Thai, Chinese, how is that possible?
Generally, no, we work with machine learning techniques, so it is mainly deep learning techniques. So it is the same model architecture that we can train on different language. So sometimes there is some adaptation to deal with one language to others, because for example, for Arabic, we have some diacritics, more the alphabet is of a bigger size than Latin, but the main architecture is mainly the same. So there is some extra processing, some adaptation for multi-script recognition.
Right, very good. And what were the biggest challenges that you faced during this research?
In a document, you mean? There is many, many challenges. Degraded document is a challenge. Also, in another project, we work on ciphers documents. In ciphers documents, it means that the kind of documents that was used in the 13th century for secret religious and political exchange of documents. And in ciphers, the characters are scripted. The text is scripted. So here, it is another difficulty because We don't have many labeled data. We don't know what kind of alphabet it's used, the samples. We don't have any idea. So this is also was a challenging project that we have dealing in collaboration with the Computer Vision Center of Barcelona in Spain. And here we have proposed many techniques like few short learning to deal with this problem, domain adaptation, that is techniques to deal with the data scarcity for training mainly.
Right, and I want to connect the dots here. How did you continue what you learned in your project, in your doctoral studies, into what you're doing right now?
Yeah, The models, the machine learning models, is completely different, because in my PhD we don't have deep learning when I conduct my PhD. So I, for example, in my PhD we have used the Markov chain, the Markov models. It's a kind of machine learning models. In this epoch it was the state of the art models to transcribe text. Now it is different with the arrival of deep learning. It is different because before, with hidden Markov models, we need to work on the future extraction step. With what we use handcrafted futures, it is generally we need many months to develop some futures to put them as input to the model. Now with deep learning is more easy because deep learning can learn automatically this kind of futures. We don't have to work with handcrafted futures. So it's different, but the main idea, because you use machine learning, we need to data to train the models. This is common between the two approaches, but there is some difference. For example,
but you're still focused on pattern recognition. Very good. And tell me something about, can you describe the transition from being a student to becoming a faculty member and researcher?
Yeah, it's very different, because when we are a researcher, an associate professor, I start to build my team, my research team, when I come back to Tunisia. So we start with few members. It is PhD students, so we need to learn them how doing research. So what I have learning from my experience, I need to give them to my students. And after the team is bigger, so we have many members, researcher in the team. We have many projects, mainly with industry, with international partners. So we, in this stage, I must to learn how to deal with a project, how to collaborate with partners, how to give the works to my students, the work plane. So it is different.
Right, and I want to talk about the creation of the Deep Vision research team at CRNS. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, it's because when I come back in Tunisia, our research center is new. So yeah. I was from the first researcher that integrate the research center. And in this case, when you come back to your country, you have two choices: integrate an existing team or build your own team. So I
Indeed.
Choose the second solution, which is more difficult,
yes.
But there are many challenges with this solution. Yeah, I choose to build my team, to work on my favorite research field. So this is a choice.
And are you satisfied with the results?
Yes.
Very good. And tell me, how has your research focus shifted over